Shape Note singing is best experienced live, in the moment, with voices joined together in powerful, resonant harmony. But for those who can't be in the room, recordings offer a window into this living tradition, capturing the energy, the imperfections, and the communal spirit of the music. For this episode of Sing Loud Podcast, we've taken a historic WFMU broadcast recorded on March 9, 2002, at the Northampton Center for the Arts in Massachusetts and reshaped it into something new. The original three-hour program featured live singing and scattered interviews with singers and organizers. We've carefully isolated these conversations, creating a more focused documentary-style episode that highlights the voices behind the music. You'll hear from Peter Irvine, Tim Erickson, Rodney Ivey, Kshama Ananthapura, Kath Oss, and Phil Wiesor, as they reflect on their experiences with Shape Note singing, what it means to them, and the role it plays in their lives. Thanks to Eliza Kavanaugh and Dan Richardson for helping to make these recordings possible, and to the Western Massachusetts Sacred Harp Community, WMSHC, for continuing to foster this tradition in the region. At Sing Loud, we don't claim ownership of these recordings. We curate them. Many of the recordings we feature are already available in digital archives or tucked away in forgotten corners of the internet. Our goal is to bring them back into circulation, making them easier to find and appreciate for those who love Shape Note singing. We're starting with Peter Irvine, a longtime Shape Note singer and a major organizing figure in the Western Massachusetts Sacred Harp community.
And with this group of people, this sort of community in Western Mass doing this kind of music.
Uh-huh. Well, there was someone else will tell you about the monthly singing that used to happen at the home of Ruth and Richard Hook,
okay,
which went on for several years. And my friend Tim Erickson told me about it, and one time I finally went and found out how excellent it was. And over time, that grew and more people started going to that. And there's certainly a little core group of people that would show up every time. And those people were also doing other music projects. Cordelia's dad, Northampton Harmony, and various offshoots of those groups. Mm-hmm. And we sort of talked about how, well, one day we should have a convention. We should just have a big event. Because we're starting to have enough singers to do it, and we've been other places to conventions and had a good time. Mm-hmm. And then a few fortuitous events came together all at the same time. Allison Schofield started a weekly singing in Northampton at the Helen Hills Chapel at Smith, and that started off, and she decided she was going to do that every week, no matter what happened. First few weeks, only a couple people showed up. You know, 1 week it was just her and someone else, and she kept doing it.
Wow.
After like 3 months, there was a decent crowd of one or two dozen people, and it just kept growing. Like every week, there would be two or three more people. And in December of that year, I guess that was 98, we had a get-together with a bunch of these people that had been doing the singing and said, okay, we're going to do this thing now. We're going to have a convention. And I think it was Kath Oss who came and talked to the Northampton Center for the Arts and got the space and just set a date. She said, okay, it's going to be this date. And then everything just sort of came together and happened because all these people that had enough experience with these things to know how to do it, it was just like everyone did some little thing and suddenly there was a convention and like 200 people showed up.
What year was the first year?
It was 1999.
Okay. So this now is the fourth year?
Yeah, this is the fourth one, and it's grown tremendously already. There's over 200 people here today from around the U.S. and people from England as well.
People from England came. Is this the first time that they've come?
Or have I'm not sure if people came last year from England. They may have, but they're different ones this year.
Uh-huh.
And there's a bunch of people from the West, from the South, Midwest, really all over the country.
Yeah. And what's the connection? Is this a living tradition of music in England as well, or is it a strictly American folk tradition?
Well, the Shape Note system and the Sacred Harp style singing are both American. They, the shape notation system was developed in the States in the early 1800s and used in a series of books printed in New England and sung out of in New England. And the tradition gradually spread south and west with the frontier of that time. Frontier meaning like Kentucky.
Right.
And down to Georgia and Alabama.
And Missouri, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. One of the famous older books is the Missouri Harmony.
Okay.
So people were singing, you know, maybe more in the country than in the cities. They were singing in the cities at first, and then it sort of got pushed into the country and pushed further south and started to die out in New England, but was going strong in the south. And there's this guy, William Walker, who put out a book called The Southern Harmony, Southern Harmony, A Musical Companion, which the Black Crowes stole that title for their album, which has nothing to do with the book. But apparently he sold 600,000 copies of that book in the, like, 1830s.
I see.
So, obviously a bestseller.
Right.
Yeah, that's a lot of books now, let alone then.
Yeah.
And in 1844, these two guys compiled The Sacred Harp, which is the book that we still sing out of, and it's had a number of editions since then.
So this was compiled in the South?
Yeah, this particular book. We're using songs from around the States. And certainly some of the songs have roots going further back to England, but the majority of the songs were written in the States, and it's a particular American style of singing.
Mm-hmm.
The
so and then the it was singing exported has, back to England? Is that
yes, right? That's the funny thing. There's some. You can ask Tim Erickson about this too. There's been singing in this style continuously since the early 1800s, and it, you know, died down in New England to just a few small pockets, but it was still going on. And in Western Massachusetts, where we are right now, there were singing in the early 1900s, you know, these things called old folks concerts, where they would sing some of these same songs. So it kind of died down, but then it started reviving, and people in New England took it up again in the late 70s and 80s and now in the new century. And then it got exported back to England. But there's been back and forth the whole time. There was a guy in the mid-1800s who went over to England and took some of these songs over there and led these great revivals, these camp meetings over in England, singing this kind of stuff.
Who was that?
Lorenzo Dow. And that's another guy you should ask him about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been, you know, back and forth.
Now, you said that the Sacred Harp book was written in the late 1800s, is that right?
It was compiled in 1844.
Okay, so the mid-century.
Yeah.
So I noticed that in the book now there's songs that were written in the 50s, songs that were written in the late 1800s. So I guess it's been added to?
Yeah. It's there have been several significant revisions, the most recent one being 1991. And so there are some songs in there from 91 and the decades before that. But there's also some earlier revisions where new songs were added, a few songs were taken out, and some of the songs that were added are actually older songs, but they're new compositions as well. And there's people composing now, and
I wanted to ask about that. I mean,
there's going to be a special singing later today of new songs composed in memory of the September 11th mm-hmm. events.
Who's composing now? I mean, who's...
A bunch of the people here singing today.
So people are just...
Singers.
Singers, people who come to the sings and the conventions and are part of the music. And
there's an interesting variety of people involved. There's the majority are people that do not consider themselves to be musicians. There's, you know, a number of people who have a church choir background, but mostly it's just, you know, people from the community who this is the only music they do. But then there's also a number of professional musicians, a number of classically trained musicians. I wouldn't say necessarily that those are the composers, but those are some of the composers. And then some are lifelong singers, and sometimes people have been singing this just a couple of years and feel moved to write something.
Hmm. Wow. What's the religious connections? I guess I want to talk maybe specifically about in Western Mass, because I know this is a very sort of secular and liberal area.
It's pretty amazing to be in.
A lot of the songs are, you know, very heavy on the religious religious imagery. And I was thinking specifically earlier, somebody picked Christian soldiers to sing. And at this time, when there's a war going on, not everybody is entirely behind, especially in this area, that kind of sentiment is higher, I would say. And the song had really sort of very strikingly, almost, you know, political, but very, you know, heavily religious lyrics. And I wonder what kind of conversations happen within the community about that, or if they do or not.
Well, there's been a pointed effort in the Western Massachusetts singing community to be inclusive and to just be open to anyone that shows up at the door. You come in and you can start singing. And all sorts of people do show up, and it makes an interesting mix. There are a number of devout Christians involved, but also some hardcore atheists, and at least one Muslim and one Hindu. And there are a number of Jewish singers throughout the North. The lyrics are, you know, a lot of the songs are from the mid-1800s, so you're dealing with some pretty serious stuff, a lot of like doom and gloom kind of lyrics. But I personally find them to be uplifting, and I think what has really brought people together in the singing community here is the spirit of the people involved, that you can get all these diverse people together and do this thing in a room together, and you're just doing that thing, and the differences just fall off to the side. So you get an opportunity to hang out with people that you otherwise might not. And in this area, the Pioneer Valley, there's, you know, it's one of the most liberal, radical places in the country. And sometimes it gets so extreme that, you know, it becomes politically incorrect to be like religious or to be conservative or something like that. And this is a forum where people from all different sides come together and do this thing.
Our next interview was recorded during a break in the singing, catching a moment of conversation amid the day's music. We'll hear from Tim Erickson, a musician, musicologist, and professor whose work has brought shape note singing to a wider audience. Tim is known for his leadership in the band Cordelia's Dad, his work as a solo artist, and his deep involvement in American folk traditions. He was also a performer and consultant for the award-winning Cold Mountain soundtrack, helping bring Sacred Harp singing to the big screen. Here's Tim Erickson sharing his thoughts on shape note singing and its place in his musical life.
Maybe you can just tell me a little bit about how this kind of music started up in Western Massachusetts.
Well, people were singing from the Sacred Harp sporadically, I would say probably since the 1960s. More sporadically before that, in some contexts, like, you know, choirs and college choirs, occasionally doing a piece here and there. But the real Sacred Harp singing, as it is, started, the one that's sort of been continuous now and has grown, started in, I guess, the public singing started about 1990. Before that, there's a bunch of us who had been singing, just, you know, a group of friends, and we were kind of somewhat unaware of the fact that there was other people doing this, and the net has kind of, you know, widened, and more folks have been getting interested. And then we just had the first convention. We waited. A lot of places, they sort of start out with a convention, and that's the sort of the groundswell that gets it going. And we just, for whatever reason, we kind of waited here for about nine or ten years before we actually had a convention. So now this is, I guess, the fourth or something.
So pretty much the music in Western, I know, like, originally, like, way, way back,
yeah,
music started out, the shape note innovation sort of started out in Western, in New England.
Yeah, right? A lot of the composers that we're singing today were, like, you can look out down Main Street, and you can see places where some of them hung out. You can see the location over on Bridge Street, the print shop, where a lot of these songs had their first publication. There's a guy, Justin Morgan, who lived over in over near Westfield, Mass, and just a lot of other, a lot of local connections. And it was a big deal for, you know, sort of circa 1770, 1780 till, depends on where you were. Some places they sort of swept it under the rug as early as 1805. Some places it was 1820. Some places it was 1850. Some places in, here in town, there were some people who hung on to it all along. Not the shape note system. That got sort of chucked away in New England. But a lot of those old songs, sort of they were sort of hung around in the rafter, so to speak. People here and there singing them.
So not like being sung in church on Sunday, but people
occasionally.
Them,
would occasionally. Yeah, sometimes in social gatherings, there's a thing up in Charlemont, Mass. For years, I think 1875 till 1920s or 30s, there was a what they call the old folks gathering, and that was partially to honor, sort of a partially a, an old home day, partially honoring the older people in the community, and partially singing some of these old songs, as well as other other kinds of songs as well. So it, some of them have seen a lot of different uses, people using them in different contexts. But I mean, I'm thinking of particular songs. You look again down the street, down to First Church is down there, and there was a local choir master here in the 1840s, 50s, 60s. When he died, there's a newspaper account of 500 people singing. There's 163 on the bottom in the Sacred Harp, not singing it from the Sacred Harp, but that tune, which is by a local composer. Guy from Northfield, Mass. And, you know, all sorts of other little...
Local connections.
Local connections, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And so
yeah.
Then it kind of faded away in this area where when it was still going strong in the South.
Yeah, it, well, what happened was is that the these old sort of 18th and early 19th century songs and some of the mid-19th century camp meeting tunes, stuff from the Second Great Awakening, a lot of the same tunes were shared north and south and west, you know, what was then the west, like out to Ohio and thereabouts. But there was a really active movement to get rid of them because they were, you know, they weren't kosher, I guess, according to some people's...
Was music that was suppressed at some point?
Yeah, it was intentionally. People just said, that's a little too crazy. We don't want to be the, you know, hicks from the sticks. And all throughout the... I guess it was by that time in the United States, there were people sort of saying, we ought to improve, I'm making rabbit ears, we ought to improve the music. Because this stuff was just seen as by a lot of people as being a little too wild, a little too, you know. So to make a long story short, it was very, very marginalized in New England over time. There were certainly pockets. But the Sacred Harp itself, the book, is very much a Southern product. That's from Bremen, Georgia, 1844. And it drew from all the previous songbooks, took the best songs out of all of the books and sort of harmonized some that had never been harmonized, and picked and chose. And that tradition really, the convention... singing, where you come together in the square, and that's something that developed later, you know, in the mid, maybe late 19th century. And this keeps changing.
And there's, I noticed there's connections between people here now and people from the South who are up here.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that over time, there are people who sing this just love it. You know, you don't do it if you don't love it for whatever reason. It just, it's a magnet. For people, and you eventually start to get to know people from other places, and like today there's people from the West Coast, the Midwest, Canada, England, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, New Mexico, etc. And it just keeps sort of growing. The more the singing has gone beyond its roots in Georgia, Alabama, Texas, etc., the more you run into people in far-flung places.
Is there any kind of a culture clash at all? Because there's like in the South, it's still very much church music, where here it's very secularized.
Well, it's my understanding, which is not perfect, but my understanding is that, and you'll often hear this, is that this is social singing, and that the words are very important, but it's not anybody's business to tell you how to take them or what to think about them. It's just the act of singing and giving yourself, and you know, like Eliza and those guys were saying earlier about giving what you can and taking what you will. And that is something that I have found in my experience to be really pretty consistent anywhere that this music is sung. There are all kinds of little, you know, like in any group, I'm sure it happens on the NASCAR circuit, you know, there's little bumps in the road and differences of opinion, as you know, you might have seen. But the real thing is just come in saying, anything else you got, take it outside.
Right, right.
Yeah, just yeah. That with fellowship, you hear that word over and over again, and both in its most sort of religious sense and in a more communal sense, I think.
Yeah. Are there other things that you know of that have come out of the Western Massachusetts community, out of that, you know, fellowship of people who sing together here?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, these folks just love each other. It's really cool. And it's a great outlet for that. It really is very encouraging for people to just let go of some of the things that we get, you know, hung up on. And there have been a bunch of bands, any number of bands of people have started either singing or playing together out of this singing. All kinds of other projects. There's a number of people. Kelsey, who's a senior at Smith College, is doing her senior thesis. It's a dance thesis, but she's incorporating Sacred Harp. There's a couple of people who are at Hampshire College who are doing their senior projects. Mm-hmm. And a lot of interesting little collaborations and things.
I hear I'm starting up again, so I should let you go.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks a lot. It's been a good time.
Great. Yeah.
Next, we turn to Shama Ananthapura, reflecting on her experiences with shape note singing and the work that goes into keeping a strong singing community alive.
It's social, you come and get whatever you want out of it. And so I went, and it was beautiful music. And I just had to go once, and I plan my life around Tuesdays anymore because that's when we sing. So it's been so wonderful.
And you came in contact with the music here in Northampton?
Yeah, in Northampton.
This is where you live.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I live right outside Northampton in Leeds.
Yeah, okay.
And it's Northampton still. And I came here 4 years ago, and little after I came, I got into this.
Okay.
And
so are you involved then in the sings that happen at the Helen Hills Hills Chapel?
Yeah, that's my home sing. That's the regular sing that I go to every Tuesday.
Okay.
For 3 hours every Tuesday, 7 to 10.
And what was it like coming to the music? What did you think... I mean, did you have a background?
I don't know how to read music. I still don't. I can read shapes from the Sacred Harp, you know, the shape note style I can read, but I still don't know how to read music. But I sang Indian music back home. You know, I learned Indian classical music. So I kind of had some sense of, you know, tone and rhythm and stuff. But yeah, a lot of people that I sing with have never been exposed to music, and they're belting it out now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have been told, honey, you're not a singer, why don't you take piano lessons? And you should hear them now, they sound wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what is it about the shapes that makes it easier? To understand the music?
I think the very idea that it's kind of, how do you say, mnemonic device. It's like fa is in the shape of F with the prongs collapsed, you know, it's a triangle, as though the two arms of the F came down together. And so it's like the curves of the S, just inverted. And so F lies like an L with another L on top, a rectangle. So it makes it easier. And then once you know the scale, like fa, sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, fa, you know, once you get the scale in your head, you know, like the distance and range, the tune, you know, once you get that in your head, it's pretty easy. And I learn more by ear than anything. So I listen to the people around me, and I'm able to sing. So that's more how I learned it. You know?
Do you ever have problems with the lyrics? You said that like originally you were worried about the...
Yeah, I didn't know what kind of a group this was, you know, when I got the invitation from this friend. I was not sure. And initially, I should be honest, I had a little bit of difficulty singing, you know, I'm going to Canaan's land and this is my savior, Jesus is my savior. And I felt like I was being hypocritical because that's not what I believed in, you know. But then there are songs like, I mean, eventually, as I sang more and more, and the people I sang with, the fellowship that comes with the singing is so powerful that the songs take on a whole other meaning. And whether you're religious or not, let alone be from this religion versus another religion, it takes on its own meaning. Like, for example, there's a song that we sing, wonderful things of men are said when they have passed away, flowers adorn their narrow bed over the lifeless clay. And the chorus part is what gets me. Give me the roses while I live, something to cheer me on. Use less the flowers you may give after the soul is gone. Tell me what religion does it not apply to, or what person does it not apply to? You know, give me the roses while I live. So when you sing stuff like that, you know, it takes on a whole other meaning when you're singing it with friends that you enjoy singing with so much. So, yeah, right now I don't have a problem with a lot of them. Yeah, I may not believe in some of those things, but the music is so wonderful. And singing it with your friends, that's what does it for me. Yeah.
So it's very community-oriented music.
Exactly. Right? It's social singing completely. It's not performance music. You know, we don't sing for the... When you sing in a choir, you're singing for the church, right? For the people in the church.
For the audience.
For the audience. And gospel also, you're singing for an audience. This is not performance music. This is participatory music. So everybody who comes participates in the singing. And I think that's why there's such a strong fellowship in this kind of singing, because people come there to sing. And you share something like this, it's wonderful.
Does it feel like old music to you?
Old music?
Yeah, I mean, I notice here in Western Massachusetts especially, it's a very young crowd.
Exactly.
Around the music.
Exactly.
And I talked to a couple of the guys from down south who are here, mm-hmm. and they said it's a much older
crowd.
Audience there.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a lot of older folks.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how that got to be that way. There are... couple of reasons I can think of. One is this area is full of colleges. The five colleges, you know, are in this area is called the five college area. You know, UMass, Smith College, Amherst College, Hampshire, and Mount Holyoke College. So because of that, there's a lot of young crowd, and that's into all kind of music, experimental music to whatnot. And so I think there's a larger crowd of younger people, first of all. And then, secondly, I think there have been a couple of really, really good popular music bands. One is Cordelia's Dad, and all the members of the band are here today singing with us. And whenever they performed, and they had a huge following, they were a pretty big commercial success too. And whenever they performed anywhere, they loved this music so much. They always made sure they sang a couple of shape note hymns. And it sounded so good. A lot of their following was like, what was that you sang? And they said, come Tuesday, sing with us. And so that drew a lot of crowd also, I think. So there is a much younger following compared to other places.
Now, how did you come to be in the Valley?
I used to work for a software company back in Lawrence, Kansas. That's where I went to school. I went to University of Kansas. I lived there for 11 years. And then the company that I worked for moved me here. They moved here and they asked me to move. Me and another girl, you know, four of us, we moved here.
And so you came on the music pretty much right around the time you came?
Yeah, roughly. Around.
Did you find that having the music of the community of other singers?
Yeah, that was very helpful. Suddenly I had a whole bunch of friends, you know. So it forms an instant community. So that was helpful, having come here after living for 11 years in Kansas, and I had a well-established social circle. You know, a lot of people, knew a lot of people. 11 years, you grow roots, you know. And so having left that and having come here and not knowing as many people, and suddenly to bump into this and find an instant community of wonderful people that just enjoy singing for the singing's sake, it was great. It was easy to click with that and be a part of that. And it was wonderful.
What other kinds of things does that community do together besides the singing?
I mean,
see the people like another.
Yeah, we do meet outside of the singing also. But every time we meet, there is singing, regardless of whether it's a singing night or not. You know,
no matter where we meet. In the restaurant, sometimes people just.
We did that. We did that in a restaurant one time, like a couple times. You know, just soft enough not to freak people out. But every time we get together, it always ends up being a little sing, you know? And what was it you asked before that? You asked me something else.
I asked about
whether we do other things.
What kinds of things do you do together, yeah?
This singing community, there is a strong connection between this kind of singing and food. everybody's a glutton in this group. And we all enjoy cooking and eating. So that's something that happens all the time. You know, so we spend a lot of time, hours cooking and minutes finishing it and singing again. You know, it's always been a part of that. Usual stuff like all friends do. We watch, you know, from South Park to whatnot and watch TV, play games and hang out. And this group, maybe because it's a younger crowd, I don't know, there's a lot of playfulness in the sense. I know that the year I came, 4 years ago when I joined the group, in the winter, if we finished singing at, you know, we used to sing till 9 back then, 9, 9:30. We used to go to the Smith Hills, you know, behind the campus there are hills. And if it had snowed, we'd all go sledding at 9:30 at night or 10 at night and then sled for a while and then go to the diner and eat till they kick us out. That is always the ritual. If it snowed in the winter, we sing, go sledding, and then go and eat, then go home. In the summertime, on the other hand, we'd sing, and you know, the Connecticut River is right on the other side of Northampton. We'd go jump in the river, go swimming. You know, somebody or the other would bring enough t-shirts for everybody so nobody can complain, I don't have my bathing suit, you know. And we'd all go jump in the river and, you know, it was fun. And then we'd go to the diner and eat and go home. There's been a lot of, it's a fun bunch of people, you know. You get drawn into it easily.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your time.
Oh, one of the things they say about this music, which is very true and it's very interesting, is if you don't like this music, you better stay far away because it's going to suck you in. You know, it's true. A lot of people that didn't care for it so much are addicts now. So there's something about this music.
Next, we hear from Rodney Ivey, a singer deeply rooted in the tradition. Rodney comes from the Ivey family, a well-known Sacred Harp singing family from Alabama, where shape note singing has been passed down for generations. His life has been immersed in this music, and he has played a key role in keeping the tradition alive, both in the South and beyond. Rodney's commitment to Sacred Harp extends beyond just singing. He works to bridge generations, bringing new singers into the fold, while honoring the legacy of those who came before. Here's Rodney Ivey reflecting on his family's history, his experiences, and what Sacred Harp singing means to him.
We up here in Western Mass, well, they've been coming in there and singing with us, and so they invite us up here to sing with them. So I come 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You've been coming ever since?
Well, I didn't get to come last year, but I wanted to.
Did a big contingent of you guys come up from down there?
There's three of us.
Okay.
One from Fort Payne and one from Fife, Alabama.
All right.
And I'm from Henniker.
And you said you've been singing this music for years?
All my life.
All your life?
All
since
my
you
life.
Were a kid?
Yes.
How old are you now?
I'm 44. 44.
And what's the community like down there that's singing?
It's a rural area.
It's, yeah?
Yeah. We was raised down there singing this in church. We use this in church service.
So it's still, that's where it's
and we still use
it. Services.
Right.
Yeah.
We still use this in church service.
Okay. And it's been going since way back?
Oh, yes.
I know
yes.
It kind of died down in New England for a long time.
Oh, it's been going down there.
It kind of died down. What's that?
It's been going down there all the time. My grandpa sang it, my dad sang it, my great-grandpa sang it.
Okay. Are people down there composing new music?
Very few, not many. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, somebody will bring one out. And we'll try it, yeah.
And you guys have conventions?
Oh, yes, yes. We have a lot of conventions down there. We sing every weekend.
Uh-huh.
Every weekend.
And do you you have the National Convention in Birmingham, is that right?
National Convention in Birmingham. The United Convention is going to be just south of Birmingham this time.
And you get a lot of people coming down for that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Is there like a connection with African-American communities, or like gospel music, or is there Sacred Harp being sung there?
No, it's not.
Okay.
The Wiregrass singers down there, they used to be a group down in South Alabama. They just about all died out. There's probably 8 or 10 of them still left.
You said Wiregrass?
Wiregrass.
Why is it called
Wiregrass State? Because of the grass down in South Alabama.
I see.
It's called the Wiregrass.
All right, yeah. So that's just that area.
Yeah, just that one area.
Wiregrass area.
And like I said, 8 or 10 of them is all I ever see anymore. And they come to the National.
That's
the only time I ever get to see them. They used to come more than that. Mr. Jackson, I don't know if he's passed away yet or not, but he's real feeble.
I see.
He was always the leader of those.
And how about the kids? Are the kids singing it?
Oh, yes.
It's still going strong.
Yeah, my daughter sings. And
so they're not like more interested in Britney Spears than singing this stuff? But, you know.
Well, yeah.
But it's not turning them off to the music. That's good to hear.
No, we sing it. We sing around the house and everything.
Nice.
In the truck. Just all the time, me and my little daughter does.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yes.
Appreciate your comments.
For our final conversation, we'll hear from Kath Oss and Phil Wizzer. Kath Oss is a singer and musician whose work spans both traditional and contemporary folk traditions. Along with her musical partner, Phil Tyler, she has explored old-time Appalachian music, British folk, and sacred harp singing. Her deep connection to traditional music brings a unique perspective to shape note singing. Phil Wizzer is a dedicated singer and organizer working to keep sacred harp singing strong in his community. Like many who take on this role, his efforts behind the scenes help make these gatherings possible, ensuring that the tradition continues for future generations. Here are Kath Oss and Phil Wizzer sharing their thoughts on shape note singing, tradition, and community.
And you were involved in Kath in setting up the whole thing, sort of.
Yeah,
First year, right? In 99?
Yeah, the first year I was, I ended up being vice chair in 99, but I guess was part of the group that I don't know if we motivated or just like
made everything official.
Yeah, helped make it official, but had some experience with conventions and putting them on and stuff, so I saw the singers in the area. It was just like all the singers were building up and the group was getting bigger. The weekly sing started the fall before, and the monthly sing in Amherst had actually overgrown the living room. The last thing we had to put it outside.
This was the Hooks.
So. At the Hooks, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was just momentum, and conventions are a kick-ass time, so, and it helped get this group of singers together to go do that. This.
And who came the first time around? Who
a lot of these
sort
folks
of responded to the call? These folks.
We had about 150 local folks. I guess came a bunch of singers.
Officials.
Yeah,
sure.
We've got the welcoming sparkly bits.
I'm supposed to give a message to someone here.
Okay.
And the person who is here is Charlotte Ehrman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who she is or anything. I'm like doing a favor for someone.
It is.
Okay.
Usually we just kind of break in and for a singer.
And then she's supposed to call Juanita to tell her where she's
staying.
Staying
in Charlotte, it's pretty.
Because Juanita erased the message.
Huh.
Juanita's really old and she doesn't have a car and she, you know, it's all this stuff, so I'm doing her a favor.
So we need to find Miss Charlotte Ehrman.
Do you want me to try it? Just go in and sort of.
There's a,
if
you go in.
Questions?
Actually, if you go in. And then around to the back and right, there's a table kind of
okay.
raised up. If you go there and let them know that they need, they're doing a bunch of calling out stuff, and it'll be better heard if they do it.
Yeah.
So you could bring it to them and explain what the situation is. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. That'll get it.
How did people from, I know there's people from England here today, and there's people from Georgia and Alabama who I talked to.
Yeah.
People from other places?
We've got Maine. We've got a bunch of New England states covered, and New York, which is included, and New Jersey and Pennsylvania. I think there's some Virginia, Georgia, Alabama.
Oregon, Minnesota.
Oregon, Minnesota. Washington State, I think.
Hmm.
New Mexico.
How'd this happen?
A bunch of them. Well, there's sings in just about every state now, and there's a couple places where you can kind of network that stuff where you just say, we're having a sing here. If you happen to want to travel, come on over. But a lot of it's just, I mean, a lot of what makes this thing cool here is that local folks come. I mean, that's, I think, why it's been durable, is we'll have a bunch of singing schools in the area that are open to the public and free, and, you know, come learn something that pretty much rocks.
You need help beside me? Is there a story down at the back?
You can go down that one floor to the second.
Thanks.
Hi.
See you.
See you later.
How did you guys get interested in this music? I mean, I was talking to the folks from Georgia and Alabama, And they said that the crowds down there involved in this music are older. Mm. And it's very, you know, traditional church music there. Mm-hmm. Where here, one of the things that's very distinctive about this convention and the Western Mass scene of this kind of music is that it's very young crowd. So can you tell me about that?
I think in terms of ages, it has to do that do with the fact that it's not a family thing here. It was like social first, you know. And I mean, there are 5 colleges. I think it kind of naturally lent itself to that age group. But I mean, it's not all young people. Cat's pretty old.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I know, like, what year are we in? 2002. Like, 20 years ago, it was mostly sponsored by the Country Dance and Song Society. And a lot of the people that were involved in that organization were kind of in their 40s and their 50s and such. And it didn't really grab. There's a lot of stuff going on in somebody's life. If you're, like, busy doing folk music and you got a family and all that stuff. It's not necessarily that you're going to be able to build up the kind of momentum that we had to get to here, to where we are now, today. And I think that came from people hearing about it in various ways. I know I started because of peer pressure, because some friends of mine had found it in college, and they were doing it for fun in the living room. Like, did it work out?
I think it will.
Okay.
It seemed like they were
going to
try to find her.
Good.
Cool.
So it was peer pressure.
It was, yeah, because it was what they were doing. Like,
was there any
TV.
Kind of like a gateway music to get into this harder stuff?
No, this was the gateway music, because after this I started playing instruments and being in bands and stuff, because all of a sudden I found out that music can be fun, which I was not actually fun and deep, which I was not really aware of before.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Sing Loud podcast. I hope you enjoyed this glimpse into the singer's experiences and perspectives from the 2002 Northampton Shape Note Singing, as captured in the original WFMU broadcast. A deep appreciation goes out to the singers, interviewees, and all who continue to raise their voices in this powerful tradition. Whether in churches, community halls, or archives waiting to be rediscovered, Shape Note Singing remains a living practice, passed down not just in books, but in sound, breath, and fellowship. Stay tuned for more recordings, more voices, and more moments of discovery in Shape Note Singing. For now, we take the parting hand.